Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Martha Hanna. I'm a member of the History Department here at CU Boulder. It is my pleasure to chair this session this afternoon. The title is Those Who Do Not Learn History Are Doomed to Repeat It. It is panel number 2603. We are meeting on Wednesday, April 10th, 2019 at 4:30 p.m. in the East Ballroom. Historians like to record that kind of information. We have four extraordinarily distinguished and interesting speakers. I've had delightful conversations with them for the last three quarters of an hour or so. I will introduce them in turn. Each one will then speak for about 5 minutes. I will then propose a second question for them to deliberate, at which point we will entertain questions from the audience. We will use both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. And we have one, two, three producers. Okay. You must write legibly. If you are a student, because we will give priority to questions from students, please indicate that either when you submit the question on the app or on the note card. Please make your questions brief and to the point. And I would just add that because we have such a wonderful attendance and we have only 1 hour to deliberate on this question, it will probably not be possible to address all of the questions that are submitted. So we will work through as many of them as time permits. Our four speakers come with very varied and interesting backgrounds. Each of them will be able to bring extraordinary insight to the question of the panel. Peter Light is a sinologist, now retired from careers both in international banking and in teaching. He's currently on the boards of the Council on International Education Exchange and the One Sky Foundation. He's an active Princeton alumnus and serves on the executive committee of the Institute for Advanced Study. He is the author of several books, including a new book about the adoptions of his two daughters. He is a mosaicist and a Chinese calligrapher. Peter, Julian, and their two daughters now live in the Princeton house where Peter resided in the 1970s as an intimidated cat sitter. Fuchi, the dog they found in a Beijing park, now happily rules their roost. Our second speaker is David Seuss, CEO of Northern Light, which has pioneered the use of artificial intelligence to analyze and discover meaning from large research document repositories. He holds an engineering degree from Georgia Tech and an MBA from Harvard Business School. In 2017, he and his wife were presented with the William Booth Award from the Salvation Army to recognize their decades of service to the needy families of Massachusetts. He is a frequent essayist on social media on topics such as the Trojan War, American and military history, and the relationship between science and religious belief. He's also, take this into account when you ask him his questions, an internationally competitive saber fencer, a professional-level sports car racer, and an amateur blues guitarist.
Wow.
He's the founder of the Fight Against Smoking team and is a member of the Georgia Tech School of Industrial Engineering Board of Advisors. Tomford is a retired Lutheran pastor who has served as a parish pastor, a college chaplain, and college president at Bethany College in Kansas, St. Olaf College in Minnesota, and Moravian College and Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania. He holds a bachelor's degree in medieval and Russian history from Princeton and followed his undergraduate degree. He pursued an intensive course in Mandarin Chinese at Middlebury College, which led him to several years of teaching Western language and medieval European history in Taiwan. Upon his return to the United States, he completed a master's degree in divinity from Yale and a doctorate in ministry from Princeton Theological Seminary. He currently lives in St. Paul, Minnesota, where it is also snowing, and
even on the 4th of July.
And he has been an engaged volunteer in his neighborhood as a board member of the Council on International Education and Exchange, and as a co-chair of ecumenical dialogue and ministry between Moravians and Lutherans. Dr. Peter Whitehouse is a professor of neurology whose extensive research in psychiatry, psychology, cognitive science, and neuroscience, to name just a few of his fields of interest, has been foundational in the study of Alzheimer's disease. The Alzheimer's Center of University Hospitals at Cleveland Case Western Reserve University was funded with a plan written by Dr. Whitehouse, who served as its founding director. In 1999, Dr. Whitehouse and his wife, Catherine, founded the Intergenerational School, a unique public multi-age community school in Cleveland, Ohio. In his wide-ranging scholarship, numbering hundreds of academic papers and book chapters, his main focus is on eco-psychosocial models of health and aging and the cultural role of the arts, especially photography and dance. So I welcome each of our panelists, and I look forward to their reflections and observations on the question that we will pose. The panel itself does not actually pose a question. It says, those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it. I will ask each of our four panelists whether they agree or disagree with that proposition and why. Thank you.
Martha, you win the prize for the most charming introduction.
Yes.
I also say it's a pleasure to not be talking about China and to be out of my comfort zone.
Yes.
Till now. Speaking of history, I have to express my pleasure in being on this panel with Chris, because in terms of history, he and I were students 50 years ago together in Taiwan, as was Alice, who's sitting in the audience. So it's all rather thrilling.
Yeah.
Please don't dismiss my comments as the rant of an old guy, but here goes. I fear that technology is keeping us from history. I get the feeling, based on science, that the pen can be mightier than the keyboard. With libraries at our fingertips now, I wonder if history is slipping away. I have the sense that paper note-takers' brains work to digest, summarize, and capture the essence of information, promoting understanding and retention. Laptop note-takers, I think, tend to behave more like court stenographers. They lack the ability sometimes to digest information, can have trouble distilling, and I wonder if this is not learning or a different brand of learning. Because I've sat behind enough students taking notes on keyboards who are actually either watching baseball games or Googling or playing games, whatever. But it weirds me out, studying the truth. Sorry to sound so trendy. I think that the retrieval, the ready retrieval of undifferentiated material online addles our ability to analyze. Instead of Phil Spector's wall of sound, we now have a wall of data. Can information mitigate against learning history? The irony is that the more education goes digital, the more important the teacher and the educational form becomes. Learning history is not like swiping hookup opportunities on Tinder. It is about... We can talk about that. It is about honing the mind to have at least a fair chance of getting it right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, Peter, you use Tinder a lot?
Wrong side of the aisle.
Terrific. My wife is in the audience. I don't actually know what Tinder is.
Sure you do. You're
I'm a pastor. I'll tell you answers.
Great. Okay, so the question is not, or the proposition is not really posed as a question. I guess my reaction to the proposition is that history can inform our activities, both can inform it to avoid mistakes, which is what the doomed word, I think, is going for, but also to do the right thing proactively. Sometimes I'm asked to speak at MBA classes. I'm actually speaking in a class tomorrow here on campus. And what I tell aspiring business school students and entrepreneurs is to learn to be a successful leader in business and a successful entrepreneur. Don't study management. Study history. Look at what the great leaders have done that have changed the outcomes for their countries or organizations. And look at how leaders behave and the kinds of things that they do. They do things like they realistically assess the environment, which is often hard when you're in a leadership position, because you might be surrounded by sycophants who will tell you whatever it is you want to hear, and who are trying to win your favor. But the great leaders cut through that, and they get real information. They create plans that have a chance for success, and they communicate those plans. They manipulate symbols so that people can understand what their values are and what the outcomes are that they're looking for. So leadership is one of the best places that history is the best place for us to learn about leadership. And leaders change outcomes all the time. Now, there's some other themes that I have noted that I think it is important for us as citizens and voters and as leaders to keep in mind. And that is that the bad guys behave really badly, when they have more military power than the good guys. We can see that throughout history. We can see it from the Trojan War all the way through tribal violence in Africa recently. Bad guys behave badly when they have the power. We can see that just disenfranchised people revolt. And if people believe their voice is not being heard, they revolt. We can see that from the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution. Frankly, we can see it in the last presidential election. A large group of voters in the Democratic Party felt like they were being called deplorable, that their views weren't being represented by their party, and so they voted for the Republican candidate. And that's how we got the president we have now. If people had been more familiar with history, someone would have reached out to those voters. We see that over and over that market economies outperform planned economies. And you don't have to look at North and South Korea, the United States and Russia. You can go all the way back to the northern Protestant denominations, nations outperforming the southern Catholic nations in Europe from an economic development viewpoint, a military viewpoint, a technology viewpoint. Largely because their economies were less managed. So we see that over and over. Lastly, we see how critical economic development is. All of history is really about economic development. It is the nations with the strongest economies that win the wars. Over the course of history, we see a rising standard of living, which is driven by innovative technologies and material output of economies. And again, it's the large economies that can develop the technologies. Quick, name an important internet company that isn't American. One. That's a good one. That's probably the best one right there. But the internet technology companies are dominated by American companies in part because of the size of our economy. We can foster that kind of innovation. Lastly, I'd like to point out that one important history lesson is that it is the wealthy and prosperous nations that can turn their attention to social justice. Social justice is a luxury of the well-to-do. And the poor nations of the world could not care less about social justice. It is the prosperous nations. And if we really want to bring social justice to the world, we can start by developing strong economies around the world.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be part of this panel. Let me start with a story. It's a story probably only important to me, and I've been counting up here 16 other people, but since I have a captive audience and it's a story about me, I want to tell it to you. 50 years ago, 12 basketball players and two coaches and a trainer and a manager got together. We went through a season together. We had an awful beginning season. We lost in consecutive nights, for those of you who care about basketball, to Duke, North Carolina, and UCLA. So we felt kind of bedraggled. But then we won the next 17 games in a row. We went into the NCAA tournament, and we were ranked number 20 in the United States. Skip ahead to this past January. Those people, all except for one who is sadly no longer with us, gathered for a reunion. And we spent 3 days and drank lots of beer wondering about what did that event mean. We're all 70-year-old people now, 70, 71, 72, 73. I think history is something like that. An event happens, an intersection of people in a time and a place happens, and it affects the lives of those who are participants, either by intention or accident, in that event. And then there has to be, for it to be history, some sort of inquiry into what did that event mean. Herodotus was, by self-proclamation, the first historian in the West. And the word history comes from the Greek word for inquiry. It's in the very first sentence of Herodotus' first history. These are inquiries into the causes of the people and nations of the world as he knew it or experienced it. An event happens. There's some kind of inquiry into trying to figure out what does this event mean. And then various narratives, various stories are put together by various writers about what the event meant. We had lots of records from the New York Times and Sports Illustrated which defined what our experience, historical event, meant from highly qualified Pulitzer Prize winning people. But we also had our own stories. And we had a very different story from our coach and our assistant coach as things looked to them. So in any historical event, there is going to be a narrative developed, not all of which are in sync. Some are quite different, depending on the experience of the people, their viewpoint, and what they brought into that event. And around the event, often communities develop. The people of Israel develop around a story, a narrative of an historical event, the Exodus. Various other religious groups, political parties, communities of all sort. Our little tiny community of 15, 16 people is a 50-year-old community based around a narrative of an event that happened to us. Then there needs to be time to reflect upon this event. One of the great contributions to life, certainly in the West, and perhaps the whole world, is the notion of the Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. How does one keep the Sabbath day holy? By retelling the stories of Israel. Not all of the stories are in sync, even in Hebrew sacred scripture. There are different stories, depending, again, upon time and place and experience of the event of the Exodus and other events. Let me add my echo to Peter's comment that without a Sabbath, without a break, without some sense of holiness of time, without some refuge from the fierce oppression of the material world and our own anxieties about getting ahead. Without some break, we will have a hard time reflecting and critically ascertaining the stories that shape our lives. Psychoanalysis is based upon individual Sabbaths of self-reflection, self-criticism, self-responsibility, and freedom. Nations, groups, religions, philosophies, administrations must have some Sabbath moment in order to provide critical reflection upon the stories that make up their community. And finally, it occurs to me, 50 years later, after our experience as callow young lads in those little tiny basketball shorts and our Converse sneakers running up and down the floor all over the country, new narratives develop. What we thought was quite important then, two of our players were first-round draft picks in the NBA. I was a fifth-round draft pick. That seemed very, very important in 1969. It was of no importance anymore. The rhythms of our lives, the intersections of our lives had become much more important, and that's what we reflected upon critically and with celebration as we gathered to remember that first historical event. So, as we think about this topic, I wanted to simply pose a framework maybe for us to think about how critical reflection upon history and historical events happen for us as individuals and for us as communities built around that event. Thank you.
So thank you for being part of my life for an hour, and thank you to all the organizers of this wonderful meeting for allowing me to participate for a week. I do have to say that my last session on Saturday, I'll be talking about sleep, and on Sunday, I'll be going home to my wife, and I think I'm really looking forward to the Sabbath this week. No offense to everybody I'm with during the week. So I'm a futurist who became an amateur historian. So I suppose on my own behavior, I answer the question the way that it was posed. Yes, I do think if we're going to talk about the future or even the present, some historical context is important. However, I'm going to tell you two stories and then end with a bang. The first story is about the word Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's did not exist in the world as a concept until 1910, when Emil Kraepelin, who was Alzheimer's boss in Munich, Germany, decided to include Alzheimer's disease in his textbook. I'm using that date, not when Dr. Alzheimer first presented his findings at a scientific meeting where he wrote them up, because Kraepelin was competing with other schools, particularly Prague, to see who could find the most diseases and get famous by kind of enumerating conditions that cause human suffering. Alzheimer himself was not even sure that he had described a separate condition. He described it in a young woman, and that was what was unusual about it. But this was an error where the brain psychiatrists, that they were called, were just so enamored of their new neuroimaging. Have you heard that one before? It was the microscope. Alzheimer was one of the first people who used a camera to look through a microscope. And as they did that, they imagined all kinds of things that in retrospect didn't prove to be things that were useful. The book that I wrote, The Myth of Alzheimer's, actually challenges the notion that many people now agree with, that politics plays a big role in this, and that Alzheimer's itself is not one condition, and it is related to aging, and the uncertainty about what they were describing and the uncertainty about its relationship with aging were there over 100 years ago. So that's my first lesson, that we can go back in history, see there were human beings, there were politics, there was imaginative interpretation of data, and that's going on today. My second story is about the word bioethics. Bioethics was first invented as a word in 1970. Ethics had been around for a long time. But the biology, the discoveries of medicine were coming onto the fore, and people were saying there was a lot of serious value concerns about that. I sometimes run into bioethicists who don't know you first invented the word bioethics. I happen to be fortunate to be mentored by this man who is at the University of Wisconsin, not in some East Coast think tank. He actually was inspired by Aldo Leopold. So the original bioethics was a land ethic. It was an environmental ethic. Now that's a different lesson we can learn, which I'm trying to help bring back, the reinvention of the notion that if we want to consider value in relationship to health, we had darn well better include nature and our responsibilities for nature in it. So those are two stories about two words that are quite salient in modern times, Alzheimer's and bioethics, that if you understand a little bit about the history, you can see how sometimes we do repeat our mistakes and sometimes we don't remember our successes. So the other story I want to relate to is the intergenerational schools that my wife and I started. I think one of the things I say is that kids learn about the past through the eyes of the elders, a past they've never seen, and the elders can imagine the future through the eyes of the children. So that's another perspective on history and future, and that's why I celebrate this conference with all the different old age people here. One of the things we do in the school is we teach big history. Now, I mentioned this word to the real historians to my right, and because sometimes big historians are a little suspicious of people that think that big. Big history starts with the Big Bang, over 14 billion years ago. Now, there weren't too many people writing things down at that time. So, you know, the historians might say, wait a minute, we have to wait till somebody starts writing something down. But the fact that we have to put our future in the perspective of how we as a human species evolved, and you all know the timelines, you know, we're 14 billion years ago is, you know, way somewhere over in Denver. And, you know, we've been on the planet for this amount of time. So big history does give us a sense of perspective. It gives us also a sense of what we have accomplished and not accomplished on the planet. Now, we are about to enter, according to the geologists, a completely new future. The Anthropocene. The Anthropocene is a label that people are debating to give to a new geological epoch, which will signal that we're out of the Holocene. Now, I will tell you, I used to get all those graphs with ages and epochs and eras. I mean, okay, geologists. But look, they're suggesting, whether it's radioactivity, plastics, carbon, or whatever, that our species has had such an impact on the planet that they're going to name a planetary epoch after us. So whether it's in intergenerational learning or whether it's putting the human race in the perspective of 14 billion years of history of the universe, as we imagine how we are going to take care of our planet and ourselves going forward, I do think history plays a role. But I think the lessons are not always clear-cut, that what we learn and bring forward is helpful or what's not helpful. But I certainly do believe that there's much to be discussed in this panel to follow.
Thank you very much. I have been receiving some wonderful questions from the audience, to which we will turn in just a few minutes. But I would like to just turn the tables a little bit, which is going to be a little strange given that I'm the person who's supposed to be defending the history. That's my job. Each of our panelists has presented, I think, very compelling, though very different ways of thinking about defending the value of history and the significance that history can bring to how we understand the present. And I appreciate that greatly. What I would like them to think about or to reflect on just for a minute or two, so that we can then turn the questions over to you, is it possible that an understanding of history can be used in such a way as to mislead people who believe that they have understood the past into making errors about the world in which they live in the present? Can history be misused in ways that appear scholarly, but in fact can prompt people to arrive at not only erroneous, but perhaps even dangerous conclusions? You could probably write a thesis about that.
Yeah.
I think history is readily weaponized. It seems very clear to me. But they can only be weaponized by people I don't like. but I'm objective about all this. But I think that someone with an axe to grind who can also be learned can misuse history.
I am reminded of the Confederate monuments controversy. There was one recently, last year, maybe a year ago, forgot exactly, the one in Virginia about the statue of Robert E. Lee being removed. For those of you who don't know the history of Robert E. Lee, he was opposed to slavery, thought it was unchristian. He had married a family that owned slaves. His family didn't. He never participated in the management of the plantation. He was posted on military assignments his entire life, and he went, even when he was in Virginia, he went to his office in Washington, D.C. He freed his own slaves before the 14th Amendment was passed, and he used his position of high moral authority to try to convince the South to free all the slaves. If we want to make a statement against slavery, we should take every school child in the United States, take them in front of a statue of Robert E. Lee, and teach them what Robert E. Lee thought about slavery. And I think that's an example. We have people who think the statue represents one position. It doesn't. We have another group on the other side of the street who thinks it represents that position. Both sides are wrong. And they're both basing it on a complete misunderstanding of history. I think it's an indictment of the educational system, frankly, the whole Confederate monuments controversy, at least as it applies to Lee.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question. I'm thinking of my two cousins in Germany. My father emigrated from Germany in 1922 and left a number of brothers and sisters back there. Several were killed in the war. The two sisters, my cousins, have a very different understanding of what the Nazi period meant. And they garner articles from newspapers, from historians, from the Bible to defend their views. One, Heide Marie, believes the Nazi period was not so bad as people thought. There was no such thing as a Holocaust. And her father, who died in the war, was dying to defend German culture. The other one, Gudrun, has the exact opposite view. Her father also died in the war in Russia, taken prisoner, actually was not declared dead until 1965. She believes the Nazi period was atrocious, not only because it caused the death, brought about the death of her father, but it brought about the death of tens of millions of people, primarily Jewish people, who happened to live in their town. And she too garners historical evidence, biblical stories, which she has to her part. So when I go to Germany about every third or fourth year to visit these two people, it's quite difficult to have a discussion, because the discussion has been going on since 1938 and 39 when they were born. I wasn't there then. Since 1947 when I was born. And there doesn't seem to be any way to resolve it, because they had the same historical experience but garner very different information to interpret it and to defend their positions. And I think in many ways to bring some kind of resolution to their own psychological issues which they themselves experienced during the war and immediately thereafter. So, yes.
Thank you.
So I absolutely agree. In fact, as I began to study history, I became more confused about what history was. Mm-hmm. I do believe we reconstruct history in the present in order to justify actions to create a future state. And depending on what your interpretation of the present is and where we're going, where you want us to go, that's going to be a different interpretation. Historiography is the study of the history of history, and meta-history is all about how, if you look back and you think, you know, we tend to get taught history like a timeline, as if who's going to disagree about, you know, the beginning of World War One or whatever else. In actual fact, it's not a linear timeline. And the idea that historians are culture bound like the rest of us, and they tell history the way that's reflected by when they are being historians. So I think that the idea that history is a little bit more fluid than maybe we're taught is an important point, because it does kind of frame exactly what everybody else has been saying, that who you are, where you are, where you want to go will affect how you interpret the past.
Thank you very much. I will turn to questions that have been submitted by the audience. I've been delighted to see we have several student questions, which we will turn to first. And the first question I would like you each to reflect on is this. History is a kind of societal memory in addition to a collection of names, dates, and places. Do you think that the value of history lies in its power to create identities, or in the pragmatic use of such information to solve current problems through the observation of similar patterns in the past? Wow! Give that guy a degree right now.
That was a PhD student, I hope.
That's right.
So there are two parts.
It's 17 parts.
So that part about memory, could you repeat the question?
So let's
what was that about Alzheimer's?
I think because it builds on observations we've just had, let's tackle the first part about the role of history in helping create identities.
Yes.
And is that a positive? Is it a conflicted? Is it potentially negative? Is that one of the important functions that history can perform? To create identities.
Yeah, there's a discipline in my area of study called Heilsgeschichte, holy history, that the history of the people of Israel and the history of the Christian church, at least, is determined about the interpretation of what those two communities believe are historical events. And there's a good bit of tension, certainly within those broader identities, about what the events were and what they might mean and how to gather accurate data about when and if and so forth these various things happened. But the identity of those two religious traditions is absolutely dependent upon an understanding of history.
Thank you.
I think the almost compulsion of human beings to act in tribal ways is one of our worst qualities. And history tells us that the temptation to do that is overpowering. Mm-hmm. So the question deals with social memory and creating identities, and that makes me shudder because A, I think it's true, and B, I think it's terrible. When we start to reason about other people using tribes as the metaphor or the categorization methodology, red flags should start waving, lights should blink, womp, 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 should be sounding in the background, because we're on the verge of making a mistake, it seems like to me, more times than not. History says tribes really matter, people behave tribally. Boy, I hope we outgrow that.
Thank you. Peter.
So let me talk about the tribes within universities, including the historians.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly speaking, I think this is an important question from the student. The idea that I consider myself a neurologist, a neuroscientist, a bioethicist, all relates to how I describe how that label got applied to a group of people who adopted it for whatever reason. I'm going to make the critique from the perspective of my academic perspective, which is a transdisciplinarian. I think we have thought that universities are structured around disciplines can solve social problems. And we're increasingly recognizing that it doesn't take a historian or a social scientist or a psychologist working in isolation. And so it's another example of breaking down the tribal boundaries between the disciplines so that we can tell a story of a university, which is a university that actually has also a serious responsibility for helping us address problems in the world which increasingly don't fit into boxes that we've constructed in universities.
Peter.
I think it's important to recall what Peter said before about history not being a linear matter. Right. To me, history is very organic and alive and moving and growing all the time. And at the risk of talking about a personal matter, I actually feel that I'm part of a wonderful kind of history. I am part of a two-father family with two adopted Chinese daughters living in a community and watching history change around me. Mm-hmm. And I refuse not to be an optimist because of what my children have done for me in this world. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And do we want to...
How about this?
What? Yeah, and the second part of the question
right.
is whether, and we've begun to touch on this, but the pragmatic uses of history. So not just in saying, you know, I am who I am because of the 12,000 things that ever happened to me, but what I have learned about the past can inform the way I will think, we would hope, in a critical and rational way about the challenges that we confront today.
Go for it.
So I am a physician. What does a doctor do if you're lucky and they talk to you long enough? They take a history. And that's a very interesting process. Actually, I think it's too much an abstraction process. But back to the first question we were asked, if the doctor takes the history in the wrong way and puts you in the box, the wrong box, and gives you the wrong diagnosis, that's a very good example of not paying adequate attention to history and making a practical problem. So I do think there are many aspects in life where listening and attending to what somebody else is telling you about their history that you're not going to take, you might borrow it, but what you want to do as a doctor then is to co-create the narrative, to create a story that fits into the person's history, so hopefully together you can make a change for the betterment of the particular person you're trying to help. So I think the example of medicine and history is perhaps a practical application.
Thank you. Another question from a student. And I think given our panelists' expertise and international knowledge of the world, this is one that they will be able to give us a great deal of insight on. How do American students in the 21st century, and the way in which they study history, how does that differ from the way in which their contemporaries in other countries in the world study history? Mm-hmm. And why does that matter?
Mm-hmm. I'll have a go at this. I think we are a country now of language cripples. With the decline of the study of foreign languages, we are hiving ourselves off from the world at our peril. And anyone who ever talks to me, you know, what will I do this summer? And, you know, I don't know what to do. Just go study a language. It's the most important thing you can do. One of the problems about dealing with China, it's very interesting. The Chinese now are learning English at a tremendous rate and at a very high level. It's very, very impressive. And that makes it easier for foreigners, vis-a-vis the Chinese, not to learn Chinese because they speak English. Well, I would venture to say that the more the Chinese learn English, the more they mythologize themselves into making us think that there's something really impenetrable about China. China is knowable. They know about us. We can know about them. But we must learn these languages. And language courses are dying on the vine all over the United States now because it's not part of some stupid MBA program. Sue me. That's what I feel about it. If I had my choice, every MBA program will be shut down. Never mind. That's another panel.
You heard it here.
I've got mine. That's okay. Go ahead.
Go to Middlebury. Go to Monterey. Go abroad. Study languages. I'm done.
Okay.
Très bien. Très bien.
I don't know anything about how people learn history around the world, but I'll answer the question anyway.
Sure.
Because I have an MBA. I would observe that the internet has a contribution to make here. I like to write answers to questions on history on social media site Quora. And my answers are read on a good week 20,000 times. The questions are posted on history by people from around the world, and they're answered by people from around the world. And it is quite interesting to look at the different perspectives. I answered a question on the Falkland Islands War and how the British Army performed and Navy and Air Force. And people were weighing in who were clearly anti-British, and other people from Britain who were clearly happy that an American thought they'd pulled it off pretty well. And the debate was raging there between people from different countries. And an exchange was occurring, an exchange of viewpoints and information and perspective. And so, you know, I like the internet and its contribution to the us all gaining a more international perspective.
This is kind of a strange answer, perhaps, so no booing allowed. I think there's in our everyday lives we are learning history. So I'm with you. I don't know exactly how people in Switzerland learn about Charlemagne or Toulouse-Lautrec or something. I don't know how that happens. But the immediate thought that comes to my mind, if we have some number like 84 million misplaced, displaced refugees in the world right now, they are learning history. They are living a history which is radically different than anything I am experiencing, or I'm guessing the vast majority of students at the University of Colorado are learning. So part of learning history is a discipline, a way of thinking, a way of approaching what has happened since the Big Bang Theory. But part of learning history, too, I think, is the history we learn as we go through life, and their experience, as, insofar as I understand it or know about it, is horrendous. So the 10-year-old woman in the Myanmar refugee camp at Bangladesh is learning a history that will take a long time, if ever, to heal. So that's what comes to my mind.
Absolute pass on that one.
Okay. As I look out at the audience, I realize that we have students. We also have people who are continuing in lifelong learning as students. Mm-hmm. So we will turn to probably a non-student question. There is a smugness in many today who think that we have solved our problems. And I think perhaps the culture of Silicon Valley contributes to that. That's my own parenthetical remark. We believe perhaps that we have solved the problems of racism. I don't think we believe that. Sexism, world wars. The concern is that this contemporary conviction that we have solved the problems of the past gives short shrift to the voices of older generations who have lived through experience. How would you respond to, are we becoming more and more presentist, and in so doing are undervaluing the experiences of people who have lived through experiences in the past?
I cannot help, when you talk about solving problems, to mention the book The End of History by Francis Fukuyama. Mm-hmm. He basically said Western democracy, it was a sophisticated book, and he's a very sophisticated thinker, and I'm making it very simple, but he basically said, look, history is over, democracy won. That was just a few years ago, and I think we all realize that there are still some issues ahead.
I'm the last person to be smug about being deluded about solving our problems. I find myself in a world now that is inconceivable and unrecognizable to me. Mm-hmm. Not only this country, but Europe, Russia, mm-hmm. and funnily enough, China is the outlier that's going about its business according to a strategy. Mm-hmm. It's not good, it's not bad, but all these other moving pieces have pulled the rug right from out from under all the things that I thought I believed in and took comfort in. So I am farthest from smug as one can be.
Thank you.
Well, I think the future is bright for complexity. And complexity will create new history. There are some changes, which I think we can take some credit for. One is the amount of interconnectedness from communications, technology, lifestyle perspective between people who used to be enemies. And it's getting harder and harder to imagine global war than perhaps it was earlier, because the economic devastation would be well understood by both sides. So I think there are. I do hope that there's not a lot of military history in the future. But on the other hand, I think the young people that I know don't believe that we have solved all of these problems. They are sort of mad at us for not making more progress and eager to get their chance. And I'm eager for them to get their chance.
I think it might be a Western notion that progress is the measure of all things. I don't know that the fundamental life of people internally is better or worse. Anxiety, rejection, fear, love, hate, judgment. I don't know how we would measure that if people are less anxious and more anxious now. Earlier today, I met with a group of two groups of students, and they were all international students studying here, studying engineering, and they're taking a humanities course. And I shared with them a book by Reinhold Niebuhr, written in the early 50s, right after the explosion of the hydrogen bomb. It's called The Irony of American History. And his thesis is that as the United States has become more and more and more powerful, the most powerful country in the world, able to blow up the world thousands of times over again, the more anxious the American population has become and the more insecure. And the other irony he records in this book is that the greater the prosperity of the United States, as measured by GNP, the more poor people there are in the United States, and ironically, the more people are worried about being able to retire, being able to buy a house, being able to buy food. So the fundamental condition of human beings is what concerns me, not so much our material or militaristic progress, and so I would want some attention focused upon people's capacity for love and hope, as well as people's capacity and experience of fear and rejection and judgment.
And if you will allow me to just piggyback on some of the comments,
sure.
The idea that the world is too economically interconnected and dependent as a guarantee against global conflagration. As a historian of the First World War, I remember that in about 1910, there was a very prominent book published that made precisely that argument, that World War was impossible in 1910 because the economic costs of war would be so devastating that no powers would become engaged in war. Didn't quite work out the way they thought it was going to.
Can I ask you a question about that book? Did it measure how interrelated the economies were, and can we apply those measures now and see if they're different or the same or less?
I don't remember. But the second point, so that's the pessimist in me. The optimist in me also draws in a lesson from the First World War, which is when we think about, did Europeans in particular learn any lessons? 100 years later, at the end of the centennial of the war, Europeans from gathered in northern France around a site that is, I think, an extraordinary and genuinely unique way to commemorate the war. It is the first international memorial to the losses of the First World War that lists the names of all soldiers killed in this particular sector, not by national identity, but strictly in alphabetical order. And it therefore, reduces the significance of their national identity and assigns that a soldier from India and a soldier from Germany and a soldier from France and Australia and Canada, they were all human beings in this same conflagration. And I think the fact that the Europeans have got to that point that where they could make such a memorial suggests that they have recognized the perils of nationalist identity. So that's the optimist in me. Mm-hmm. The pessimist is, I'm not sure that they're going to say, well, we can't go to war because it's going to cost us too much.
I would urge the Brexiteers, the Poles, the Hungarians, and the Italians to pay a visit to that memorial.
Absolutely.
Amen.
Absolutely. We have time for one more question. Mm-hmm. And the question relates to the observation that knowledge about history is now available and exchanged on the Internet. And is it possible that even in that forum, which is so broad and wide-ranging, that one perspective can become dominant and therefore affect the way a large community can understand the past? That's a tough one, right?
Let's see. I think the Internet is an engine of fragmentation, and I think that's fabulous. Viewpoints come from everybody, every gender, every country, every age, and they get expressed. And so, to me, I think the Internet is defense against a single view emerging and being managed and orchestrated, and we should make sure it stays free. It's quite interesting that the people who most hate the Internet are the ones who are the governments that are most totalitarian. The Chinese, Russia wants to build its own Internet now, and then unplug the other one. And it's not an accident that those are the places the ideas are coming from. You know, back in the early days of the Internet, there was this phrase, information wants to be free. And that was really more of a business model idea at the time. But I think we can apply it ever more so now to discussions of politics and history. So I don't think the Internet, I think the Internet is a good player in this whole thing. You can expose yourself to so many different views so quickly, and there's no other way to do it.
Well, I think on that point, I'd like to thank...
I think that the very value of the Internet that you describe is all the more valid if education is emphasized so that people
right.
enjoying the Internet have discerning minds.
Amen. Thank you to our panels.
Thank you.
Wonderful. And thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so proud of our students. Those were really wonderful questions. Thank you very much.